This is the JN Podcast. I'm Phil Dave, and coming up on this show, Tracy Ann Oberman will tell us why she has become a judge on the Jewish News' latest incentive, 80 over 80. Maureen Lipman talks about a newly unearthed manuscript by her late husband, Jack Rosenthal, which is going to be performed by various Jewish stars. Joe Gross, who's the Director of Communities and Strategy for the United Synagogue, will tell us how the US slowly but surely plans to get back to a sense of normality. And on that subject, we'll also be speaking to Rabbi Charlie Baginski, who's the Interim Director for Liberal Judaism, about their plans as well. And comedian Ashley Blaker will be back for another installment of some wise words during these rather unsettling times. But first, it's time for our newspaper review, as we tend to start this show off with. And joining me to go through it is news editor Justin Cohen and features editor Fran Wolfish. Welcome to you both.
Hi, Phil.
Now, let's start off looking at the front page. And the headline reads, "We've never seen anything like this." This, of course, refers to the situation with COVID-19 and how it's affecting the community.
This week, actually, a bit of a sad milestone for the UK Jewish community, in that the Board of Deputies confirmed 500 Jews have now died of coronavirus. So we've passed the 500th death. Now, if you compare that with 308 deaths in Israel, but that's in the whole of Israel, they have a population of more than 6 million, a Jewish population of more than 6 million.
And that's obviously compared to the 270,000 something that we have here of Jews in the UK. So there's
absolutely
a stark difference.
It just really shows that the UK Jewish community has really suffered from this pandemic. And the Institute for Jewish Policy Research, known as JPR, their researchers have looked into the possible reasons why. And actually, they say they don't know why. They say it's a sort of a mysterious Jewish factor, if you will. If you think about the sort of the average socioeconomic and health profiles of the UK Jewish community, technically we should have fared better, but actually that doesn't seem to have had the that hasn't had to have any effect at all. And when you take age and geographical profile into consideration, you know, that will work against us. Jewish communities generally tend to live quite closely together in sort of clusters, as you were, in certain areas of the country. And we do have an older population. So if you take those factors into consideration, that might partly explain this, but researchers are looking into why the Jewish community has sort of suffered.
And what's particularly interesting about this as well for the community is that there are a lot of people who have attributed this to when the rules of lockdown first were announced, some members of the community weren't that quick to act on it. They tried to defy it in many instances. We saw several reports suggesting that some weddings went ahead regardless. And there were lots of different events, whether it be from synagogue gatherings, that happened almost regardless of the fact that the rest of the country decided to lock down. A lot of people say that that was something to do with it. As you rightly identify, that we have a much older Jewish population probably than most of Israel has. And all of these things considered have probably played some part in it. It's all really mind-baffling. And the fact that the JPR don't actually know the answer to it makes it even more of a mystery. But I dare say that knowing the amazing work they do, that they will find some answers for us before long. We do need to move on because we're up against it. Let's move on to page 8. And speaking of moving on, Mark Regev, Israeli ambassador, he's moved on, Justin.
He has. Last weekend was here, his final days in the country. And after 4 years at the helm of the embassy here in the UK, Mark Regev, of course, came to the UK following his high-profile role as spokesman for Bibi Netanyahu over many, many years. So he was well known to the UK Jewish community, but it was very in a different capacity, I think, that we came to know him in recent years. He became a very respected diplomat within politics and within civil society in the UK. And I think he will be sorely missed. There's no doubt about that. And of course, with his soon-to-be successor arriving in the UK later this summer, Zippy Hotovelli, I think we may have perhaps seen a golden age pass now, and we can expect some maybe some more choppy waters ahead.
Indeed we may, especially after we heard in last week's programme the reaction that Sipi Hotovelli has received thus far. So let's hope that things don't turn sour. But let's move on and to a nice story now. We like nice stories. And page 28 and 29, Fran, there's a double page spread for you, Noch, because you've been looking at some of the amazing volunteers that have been unsung during lockdown.
Well, yes, we've called them the unsung heroes because actually lots of charities, as we know, were severely affected by lockdown. They effectively were sort of shut off from the activities and events they would normally run, especially for fundraising to continue those services. However, a lot of them have been brilliant in adapting to this new online world that we have. And we've highlighted this week some of the amazing volunteers who are still carrying on doing what they were doing. We have the Shabbat walking group, for example, who used to go and visit care homes, particularly the Jewish Cares Sydney Korob House in West Hampstead. And of course, they can't actually physically go into the care homes anymore, so they've been having chats instead over Zoom. You know, we have Jamie, who obviously mental health has been such a massive thing during lockdown. They've been brilliant. They've actually provided people with iPads who don't have iPads, so just so they can stay in touch with people, and they've set up sharing circles and support groups, even a poetry reading night. And we have some amazing ladies as well over at High Cancer Care, who they used to have a social group on a Wednesday, and they've gone virtual with that as well. So they've got online bingo. They're even having a summer party next week, Phil. I mean, it's amazing. They're doing all of this
socially
online.
Distance, I hope.
Yeah, I mean, it's just incredible. It's mind-blowing, and I absolutely salute these volunteers because it's not been easy for anyone. And to have to suddenly move everything that you do to an online platform, if you've never done it before, can be quite difficult. I think they're all doing a brilliant job and looking after the service users in a wonderful way. And what more could you ask for?
Well, quite. We have a lot to celebrate in our community and even more people potentially to celebrate. Because, Justin, it would be wrong of me not to observe that it would appear at surface value anyway that the Jewish News does enjoy a list. And the latest list is 80 over 80. Would you be so kind as to explain to us what this new initiative is?
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing we like more than a list, Phil, as you know. And this is a brand new initiative, never been run before, either by us or we think anyone else within this country, to actually have one of these lists focusing on the older age range. And really, this was inspired by the spirit. We're drawing on the spirit of Colonel Tom, and also in light of the fact that older people have quite often in recent times felt somewhat sidelined. And this is really to celebrate all those octogenarians and older within our community who are doing incredible things, whether it be volunteering, whether it be in philanthropy, whether it be in education, whether it be in charity, in all sorts of areas. Holocaust survivors as well, who are continuing to tell their stories on a weekly basis in normal times. And we want to bring together all these people to highlight their stories, to celebrate what they've achieved, and really to shine a spotlight on the older generation in our community.
Now, there are going to be those who are listening who say, oh, I know someone who's an octogenarian who's well and truly deserving of an accolade. And they're probably going to want to know how they go about nominating them.
Yes, I'm delighted to say that from Friday the 26th, it'll be possible to go onto our website, jewishnews.co.uk. We've got an online form. The story will be prominently placed for the time being. And for the next 6 weeks or so, 5 to 6 weeks, people will be able to nominate their heroes. And we hope to be able to reveal the final 80 who won't be ranked on this occasion, I hasten to add, and we'll reveal that list later in the autumn.
Fantastic. Well, we very much look forward to it. Thank you both very much indeed. Sadly, that is all we have time for a look at the paper. But do not forget that you can collect your copy of the Jewish News every Thursday. And if you happen to be stuck indoors isolating, you can always find the full paper as it would be printed online at jewishnews.co.uk. News editor Justin Cohen, features editor Fran Wolfish, thank you both very much indeed.
Thank you, Phil.
Thanks, Phil.
This is the JN podcast. Well, as you've just been hearing, there is nothing the Jewish News like more than a list. And the newest of those lists is the 80 over 80. However, putting this together doesn't just happen by itself. I think one essential part of any list compilation is a judge or two. And I'm delighted to say what a splendid judge we have in the form of Tracy Ann Oberman, who joins me now to discuss this further. Tracy Ann, first and foremost, thank you very much for speaking to me on the JN podcast. What is it that first drew you to becoming a judge on the 80 over 80 list?
Because I think the older population in the country in general is pretty much undervalued and overlooked, because I think they've given so much to us as it, both historically and educationally, socially, everything. And we have a great debt to them. And I think also in our community, the emphasis is very much on youth and outreach for youth. But I think to be able to honour the older members of our community and society is much needed.
You know, it feels as though, now that you've said that, it's almost like a light bulb moment. It feels as though that the more senior members of the community have been overlooked for so long. I know that we often speak about Holocaust survivors. That's fine. That's certainly one aspect. But let's not forget that not everyone who's a senior citizen is a Holocaust survivor. And it's very easy to forget those of a certain age. And it just feels as if this is hopefully a much needed boost to that element of the community.
Very much. But more than that, I think it sends out an arrow generally in the community, in large, not just the Jewish community, to say what a massive debt we have to our older citizens and what they have done and continue to do. And I think in our Jewish communities, how many of them have established the way that we live now and how much freedom we have to practice being Jewish and however irreligious or religious or identifying or non-identifying as we want to be. But those people, we owe them an enormous debt. So I think it's great that this initiative is taking place.
Now, of course, 80 over 80 means that there's going to be quite a few people to choose from. Have you thought about how you're going to be judging the worthy recipients of the titles?
Well, I just want to see, well, I know who I would, you know, I personally would like to have a nod of thanks to Lord Leslie Turnberg, who I think has been a fantastic leader in our community. Many religious leaders and charitable people. Also, there are Holocaust survivors whose work has been unbelievable, like Lily Pullman and Susan Pollock and many, many others. And I'm looking to see who is nominated. I can think in my own community at South Hampstead, some fantastic members who have done so much. And, I guess just to see across the board, arts, religious, community, charity, outreach, education, seeing what comes in.
Now, for me, when growing up, a pivotal part of my childhood was turning to my late grandmothers for inspiration and my late grandfather. But sadly, he died when I was about six. So I don't remember him that well. And the other grandfather I never knew. But anyway, the point is that I had many older people in my life, in the early part of my life, who are a great influence to me. And I just wondered whether or not, sort of, are you in that same position? Did you ever look up to older members of your family, for example, and how have they stayed with you?
Oh, totally. I think that, you know, I've often written about it. I think one of the incredible things about the Jewish community is how is the wide segment of ages and experiences. You know, my earliest memories of being at Seder with my great grandmother, Annie, who came from, you know, pogrom ridden Belarus, who barely spoke any English, you know, down to the youngest member of that Seder table, who was my cousin, who was 6 months old. So every Friday night was full of grandparents and great grandmothers and younger people. So we are such a cross-generational community and religion. And I think that's a beautiful thing. I think of my great grandmother, who totally informed me. I've said many times, sitting there watching Fiddler on the Roof with her and her looking at it and saying in her broken English, this is a documentary. And, you know, also listening to my grandmother growing up in the East End of London, fighting in Cable Street, my great uncles talking about the grand trade union tradition of the East End where they grew up, the religious, you know, Holocaust survivors, all of it, it really important. And I think we can never underestimate, as families and as a community, how wonderful it is that we do mix across the generations. I think it gives us a very big, wide peripheral vision.
You know, it's funny. I was also thinking about how it seems in this day and age that those who are over 80 don't seem to behave like over 80-year-olds the way I somehow remember them. So in other words, when I was younger, someone who was over 80 was incredibly old and got to a very impressive age. But now somehow 80 seems like any other age group. And yet there are also some who probably don't even admit to being it. So are we sort of experiencing, do you think, a different type of over 80?
Well, explain. Give me an example of people over 80 who don't behave like that.
Okay, fine. So I would say that those who are still incredibly active and most certainly do not depend on others, because that's a fighting example of just how wonderful healthcare is in this day and age. The fact that people can live well into their 80s independently and not have to worry about necessarily their health in the way that maybe they once did. I think of my late grandmothers who sort of, when they were in there, certainly one of my grandmothers, when she was in her 80s, became heavily dependent on her family and in the actual care system as well as such. Well, private health care system, obviously. But the point is that it just seems that she was a very different sort of 80-year-old to now. And I don't know whether or not that's my imagination. Maybe it's just because I was younger and looking up to older people.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. Listen, I think 40 is the new 20. I think all of us are behaving differently to the past generation. But I think that's the great thing. I think that society has, you know, for all the ways that people moan about the change and the breakdown of certain things in society, I think we are also living in a time where 70 is the new 50 and I think 80 is the new 60.
Right. So I think that now's the perfect opportunity for you to tell people, anyone who maybe is out there who's thinking of nominating someone who's 80 plus in their life, what is it that you're looking for? You've given some great examples of people who are over 80 who you find personally inspirational, but what qualities do you think that you'll be looking for in people who get nominated?
Well, me personally, as one of the judges and someone who's been working very hard to retell the story of Cable Street through my Merchants of Venice project, I'm looking for people who remember their past, who will talk about it and educate about their past memories of growing up as Jewish in this country, who outreach to maybe the wider community, who have given strong moral guidance, educational guidance, emotional guidance, have created politically or for the arts. Just if you can give a good account of why this person over 80 has touched you personally, which is why you're nominating them, and has affected your life, I think that's good enough. Because as that we always say in the Talmud, don't we, if you save one life, you save them all. If you can affect one life, you can affect them all.
Can't think of a better way to summarize and to finish. Tracy Ann Oberman, thank you so much for speaking to us on the JM podcast. And I dare say anyone who wants more information, they'll find it on the Jewish News website, which is jewishnews.co.uk. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Phil.
This is the JN podcast. Now, Jewish A-listers are set to perform a recently unearthed manuscript of the last play written by the late Jack Rosenthal to raise money for a Jewish cancer charity. Jack Rosenthal, of course, was married to actress Maureen Lipman, and I'm delighted to say and honoured that in quite a few weeks that she has agreed to come back already on the JN podcast. Maureen, it's a great pleasure to welcome you back to the JN podcast, so thank you for speaking to us again.
It's a sign of my age that I can't remember being on it the first time, but anyway, plough on.
Excellent work. I'm so pleased it was that memorable. Anyway, well, it was for me. Anyway, however, let's start off first and foremost, because this script that has been unearthed, where was it discovered, first of all?
Well, it's not like, you know, Jane Austen, the Watsons or something. It's, it was something that in 2002, Louise Hager, the CEO of High Cancer, came to Jack and said, would you write a 10-minute play about someone giving their parents some bad news on a Friday night about their health? And, you know, he was in remission at the time from myeloma, but he's in and out of hospital, but he decided he would, because like me, he thought it was a great charity. And so he did. And we performed it at a fundraising dinner. This was in 2002 and Jack died in 2004. Maybe it was 2003 we performed it. Anyway, I got a bunch of nice Jewish actors in my kitchen. Tracy Ann, I think, Oberman was one of them. And we rehearsed in the kitchen on a Sunday morning. And I remember this, it's very big-headed of me to say this, but I'll say it anyway, because Jack said to me afterwards, oh, all my life I've longed for a director who would go underneath the lines like that. So I tried to remember that when I was directing. Anyway, it was a very good night. We did it, I think we were at the Hilton, and there were 500 people there, and I think they raised a considerable amount of money for the organisation. So this time, Louise, 16 years later, came to me, and she was, like every charity, struggling to know how to fundraise this year. And she had this brilliant idea to do with Fiddler on the Roof, but it was, you know, it was an international idea, and it would take time. She'll do it, because she won't stop at anything.
Yes, I have met Louise on a couple of occasions.
Yeah,
I'm well aware.
Stand in her way. She's brilliant. So what can you do? So I said, well, you know, I could sort of do a one-man show for you. And her response to that was, brilliant. Could you get David Baddiel as well? I got the gist of what she wanted, which was a few names to bring in the people. And that's what then she had this idea that we could find the play. So then I didn't have it. And my daughter and son, they didn't have it. And we should have done, because it was the last thing he wrote, you know. In the end, she found it in her archive. And there it is in typewritten words. You know, that's how long ago. You can see the imprint of his thoughts on the typewriter, because that's how when you wrote on a typewriter, you know, so people seem to speak a lot more clipped because of the sound of the typewriter. Anyway, we found it, and then I asked David Baddiel, and he said, I have just told my agent, no more Zooms, no more podcasts, no more, you know, because we have been snowed under, rightly, because people just don't know what to do. So we're slightly over Zoomed. Anyway, he said, but since it's you, which is beyond kind.
Well, I mean, to be fair, I don't know whether or not anyone in their right mind would ever say no to Maureen Lipman, but yes, at the same time.
You'd be amazed.
How was that?
I'm not an actor. I'm not an actor. I said, yeah, look, there is no such thing as a comedian who's not an actor. And then I went, and I had the idea that the grandfather could be Howard, you know, because he is an actor.
Howard Jacobson, I mean.
Yeah, Howard Jacobson's going to do it. And he's been in real lockdown. I don't think he's been out for 3 months. So he's a bit wild man of Borneo. But he said yes, which was so nice and touching. And then I just had to get it. I mean, look, David and I are about 20 years too old to play the parents of a 25-year-old. But it's you know, listen, on Zoom, I can't argue with that. I'm just going to think young. And then I got Gabriella Margulis, who worked in one of my daughter's plays, and Fabienne Frankel, who played the lead when I directed The Knowledge, Jack's play. It's a really funny thing. I've just been reading through. I was looking for some Jewish jokes, actually, in case we get stuck tonight. And I found this letter from a teacher I had at Lambda, actually, Philip Headley. And he reminded me in this letter of something I'd completely forgotten, which is that on the day of Jack's funeral at Hoop Lane, a completely leather-clad motorcyclist came roaring up, and we were all, people were piling in, and he just said, excuse me, he said, is this the Jewish cemetery? I said, yes, thanks. He said, I'm on The Knowledge, and I just needed to find out, which was, you know, how much would Jack have loved that?
People have heard about this. They're going to want to know whether or not it's possible that they could get involved, that they could catch a glimpse. Where is this happening? How is this happening? You say it's online.
And I think you have to go onto the High Cancer website.
Do you know what? I would suggest that one of the best places to start is probably the High Cancer Care website. And if you don't have much luck there, I'm fairly sure jewishnews.co.uk is an alternative. Well, Maureen Lipman, as ever, a wise, I think, person once said it's good to talk. So, and it certainly is good to talk to you.
Bob Hoskins, actually.
Yeah, well, quite. Close enough.
Not me.
Close enough, but anyway. But thank you very much indeed for telling us about this. It sounds like a fascinating event and naturally break a leg.
Thank you very much.
This is the JN podcast. Now, as the country slowly but surely eases out of lockdown and tries to get back to some sense of normality, it's been announced that synagogues and other places of religious worship will be allowed to open, with certain restrictions, from the 4th of July. But what exactly does this mean for our synagogues, and how will services look if at all, different to how they are at the moment, i.e. individually or remotely. Let's find out now from Joe Gross, who is the Director of Communities and Strategy at the United Synagogue. Joe, thank you very much indeed for joining me on the JN podcast. Let's try answering that question first and foremost. How will synagogue services, if at all, look any different to how we're dealing with them at the moment moving forward?
It's a big question, and there's going to be there isn't one answer. We at the United Synagogue have 55 communities. They're all different sizes with different demographics of membership and with different approaches and rabbinic teams. So we have been issuing guidance on how they might reopen from a health and safety point of view, but also suggestions about how they might adapt their services. So the picture will look very different depending on where you are. Some of our shuls will open very quickly and some might take some weeks or in fact months to choose to open. From a very practical point of view, if you are turning up in one of our shuls at services from the 4th of July, you will see the following changes. You will be asked to wash your hands on arrival. Actually, before that, you will have already have had to have booked your space on our online booking system. And although it's really painful for us to say this at the moment, we won't be able to welcome our doors to people who have not booked in. And although that's a difficult thing to say because we like to be able to say we're welcoming to all, I think that's probably a reflection of what's happening elsewhere.
And just to clarify as well, sorry, when you say that people who have booked in, that instantly what comes to mind with that is that there are going to be people of a certain age who are not overly familiar with technology. Does that put them at some sort of disadvantage?
No, not at all. No. So they can call their synagogue offices. There's no first come, first served arrangement. People register in interest. And then based on capacity, the priorities, the people that have booked, the wardens, designated people in the community will organise the services. Many of our communities have said that they don't want to turn anyone away. And where they can, they will run one or two additional services to enable to meet the meet need. Really, what our communities have been fantastic about doing over the last few weeks is working out what capacity might look like indoors or outdoors based on the 2 meter social distancing rule, which we're adhering to.
So there's obviously a synagogue experience. So those who may be listening who are not necessarily that religious may or may not know that actually normally synagogue services are quite mingled, for want of a better term, because obviously apart from the obvious of sitting next to somebody in shul, one of the other things you might experience is the parading of the Torah, the scroll that goes around the synagogue as it is paraded at the start of the Torah service. Now, when that happens, a lot of the time people congregate, they gather around to use their talit, their prayer shul, for anyone who doesn't know, to kiss the scroll for good luck. And of course, if they can't do that because of social distancing, how do things like that work moving forward? Has there been much thought given to that?
There's been an awful lot of thought given to it, and our guidelines are online if people are interested in the detail. You are right, we're all going to be apart from one another. It means aspects of the ritual will change. So, for example, if you have an aliyah to the Torah, you may go onto the bima, but you may go to a designated spot elsewhere to say the brachot. There will be less huddling, and most importantly for many, many people who've spoken to me about this, we will be losing a bit of the schmooze. So we go to shul for different reasons. We go to daven, but for sure we go to connect with other people. And whilst we'll be able to see community members who we've missed for a long time, there will be less chat and there'll definitely be less congregating. And that's until we settle in, until we understand where the virus is at, whether we've got opportunities to ease again. But in the first few weeks, it will be very much about making our way through the service in quite a structured way.
You know, there is going to be one question on everyone's mind. So how does the Kiddush work?
It kills me to say it. In fact, I can't believe that I'm the person saying it, but there's no Kiddush.
No.
There is no Kiddush. And I don't want to be known as the person that killed the Kiddush. But actually,
hey, look, Thatcher was the milk snatcher, so don't worry. It didn't do her career. Well, actually, I say that. But anyway, no, the point is that I think that people will be more than understanding with that. Of course, it has to be. Because there is no way around it. The Kiddush is the most interactive part of any service. But look, if anyone wants more information, Joe, where do they go?
If they go to the United Synagogue website and then look for coronavirus updates, they'll find our latest guidance. And that's actually soon to be updated again. But the very best place to go, if you want to know more about what your community will look like, is to speak to your rabbi or to the lay leaders of your communities. Because as I say, every community's experience and their response will be a little bit different.
Jo Gross, Director of Communities and Strategy at the United Synagogue, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us on the JN podcast.
Thank you.
And now from the United Synagogue, we have a look at how the Liberal Synagogue is going to be adjusting their services, because I'm delighted to say that I'm now joined by Rabbi Charlie Baginski, who is Interim Director for Liberal Judaism. Now, Rabbi Charlie, the first thing that people may observe in the difference between the United Synagogue and the way that Liberal Judaism and Reform Judaism does things is that we've managed to find ways to adapt. I know that all communities have, but we've managed to find ways to adapt to synagogue life by bringing it online for a lot of people. So we haven't been completely separated from synagogue life in, say, the ways that some of the more religious members of the community have. So is there as much of a rush for us to get back to shul?
So first, I'm going to be a bit pedantic and say that we're also the religious communities. It's just that perhaps our interpretation of religion is slightly different. And that's exactly that different interpretation is exactly what's allowed us to have the privilege of being able to do things on Shabbat and in terms of community life that the United Synagogue and other more traditional elements of the Jewish community haven't been able to do. And yes, we've been adapting, absolutely. And that gives us the flexibility now that buildings have the permission to open from July 4th, that even though we have the permission, we might not be operating in exactly the same way as once we did.
So what might that look like moving forward then?
I think, first of all, we're not one synagogue, so there's lots of different communities, and I think different communities will be a nuance between what one community might do to another, because each of our communities have quite individual circumstances, whether they're using somebody else's building, whether they're using their own building, whether they're a large community in a small space or a small community in a large space will affect what they do. But I think we're in no rush is the first point, that we're not rushing to open all of our buildings, because even if we could open fully, we know that there will be a lot of people who won't be able to come back. And so therefore, we're better putting most of our resources into having a really good online offering that's as inclusive as possible. That's a better use of our energies right now than trying to open for a small number of people in a really restricted way. That doesn't mean that at the same time we aren't looking at ways that things could happen. So if we take High Holy Days, for example, there's a big emphasis in terms of being together of looking at Tashlich, because that can happen outside and can be different for each community, as opposed to looking at a big Rosh Hashanah morning service in a building.
Now, there are, of course, going to be those who have already experienced, as I mentioned, the synagogue services for both Liberal and Reform Judaism online, which means that maybe the demand won't be there as much from Reform and Liberal communities to rush back. Does that somehow give us, as it were, more of an advantage to maybe better prepare for when synagogues can reopen, do you think?
So I think the question you ask is a huge one, because ultimately it indicates what is communal life going to look like as we move forward. And I think that there is an acknowledgement across the board for both Liberal and Reform movement that our services won't ever be completely the same again. I don't think that there is any less the need within Reform and Liberal communities for people to be together face to face and actually have that sense of being physically close. But I think that also we've heard from so many people who've said, do you know what, I couldn't get over the threshold of a building for one reason or another before this. And actually, it's not been a social distance for me. This has been a much more intimate relationship with my community. And so I think going forwards, we absolutely have to take that in mind. And I think from our perspective, we've got very, very small communities for whom this is the same thing as whether they're a very large community. The difference is before, perhaps large communities were streaming and smaller communities hadn't even crossed their mind, whereas now there's no way they'll go back without thinking about how do they have an online presence as well as hopefully a physical presence as well.
So potentially more of a hybrid, as it were, on a regular basis, so that we will see much more interaction between online and in person, whoever chooses to do whatever they want to do.
Absolutely. I think hybrid is definitely one of the steps, but I think it's also a big shift across the whole nature of what does it mean to be part of a community that will fundamentally change. And that, you know, look, often our synagogues or our communities operated, for example, mainly predominantly on Shabbat with services. And I think this will stretch out how you can be part of a community to not just the weekend, also not to simply that we're thinking about technological interaction that's reserved only for Shabbat either, but actually it's going to be much more of an integration, let's say, between, so more than a hybrid, but actually an integration between online and in person.
Well, let us hope that however synagogue life looks moving forward, may it come to us sooner rather than later. Rabbi Charlie Baginski, Interim Director of Liberal Judaism, thank you so much for speaking to us on the JM podcast.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
This is the JN podcast. Well, it's time now for some wise and humorous words from comedian Ashley Blaker as he continues his little series of monologues for us here on the JN podcast with some hopefully inspirational thoughts during these rather unsettling times.
Hello, Ashley Blaker here, back once again on the Jewish News podcast. And what incredible days we are living in, because Boris Johnson has announced, among all the other openings of pubs and relaxation of 2 metres to, is it 1 metre? I'm not entirely sure what's going on at the moment. But hidden amongst everything else was that places of worship, obviously synagogues, can now be reopened from the 4th of July. And this is big news because, you know what? I have missed my shul. I really have. I belong to a synagogue in Edgware, which actually may be incredibly orthodox, but which was strangely built above a Blockbuster video store. Although if you came to my synagogue, you'd see that compared to the other men who go there, I'm practically a Gentile. These men won't even come and see me perform unless men and women are separated by a machitza. At least that's the excuse they give me. They'd probably go and see John Bishop at Wembley Arena, no problem at all. They just don't want to see me. But I have missed the shul, and I've missed my rabbi. My rabbi, it's a bit of a character, actually, because he doesn't speak English, he speaks Yinglish. It's like a kind of half Yiddish and half English. And it's a very odd thing, because you go to Stamford Hill, and by rights, Stamford Hill, it's just by Hackney, what have you, and really, they should all speak with a Cockney accent. And they should be like, all right, mate, how are you, mate? But they don't. They'll go, hello, how are you? And this is a worldwide thing. I spend half the year living in New York, and you go to Williamsburg and expect them all to have Brooklyn accent and be like, hey, how you doing? But they don't. They'll go, hello, how are you? And in fact, I remember going to see the rabbi for the first time. He lives around the corner from me. And I went round to his house, and he said, ah, Mr. Blaker, come in. And then he said, Mr. Blaker, what is your name? I said, Ashley Blaker. He said, no, what is your name? I said, Ashley Blaker. He said, no, what is your name? I said, Ashley Blaker. He said, no, what? I thought I'm going to be here all night. And then he said, no, Ashley Blaker is just what's on your passport. That's just your nickname, what the Gentiles call you. What's your real name? Said, oh, I see. Abdul Muhammad. He didn't find it funny. If anything, I think he was a bit scared. If you didn't realise, he actually wanted my Hebrew name, which is Hanan ben Moshe Halevi. That means I'm in the tribe of Levi's. We made your jeans. It also means when the temple in Jerusalem is rebuilt, I'm going to be washing hands and feet. Orthodox Jews often say, may the temple be rebuilt speedily in our days. I would think, I don't want to wash hands and feet. I'm happy to wait. Also, all this talk about rebuilding the temple. But when it does finally get rebuilt, we're Jews, so no one will be happy. Some will say it's too hot. Some will say the air conditioning is too high. The prayers are too fast, the prayers are too slow. I don't like the way the new priest is slaughtering the animals. The old priest was much better. Give it 2 months, I guarantee you there'll be a breakaway temple for those Jews who wouldn't be seen dead in the main temple. But I've missed it. Oh, I've even missed those annoying men who come up to me in shul and ask me for a joke. Which really is very irritating. Because when you think about it, you wouldn't meet a dentist in shul and go up to them and ask them for a root canal. For some reason, people want to do that to me. I've even found myself missing the security men you get outside shuls. Last year, actually, I performed at a synagogue in the United States. And when I turned up, the guy on the door said to me, I need to search through your bags. And I said, well, come on, look at the poster behind you. That's me. And then he turned to look at it and he went, it's amazing the length some people will go to. Now, let's be honest, that would be some terrorist. He's not only walking around looking like me, he's gone to the effort of writing a Jewish stand-up comedy show, learnt it, and persuaded people to book him to perform it. I'll be honest with you, the audience is so challenging, you'd actually have to admire someone who did that. So anyway, shuls are going to reopen at last. I don't think it's going to be entirely as we remembered it. Anyway, because I read that synagogues are going to have to remain at 50% capacity, which is going to be very challenging for many of them, because they normally only get 25%. So that's going to be a bit difficult. But no singing, I read. There's going to be no singing, which is very good for the Arsenal fans, make them feel at home. Not going to have anyone close enough to you to talk to. No kiddish. Not really selling it, I'll be honest with you. In fact, I think if shuls are going to reopen on 4th of July, maybe it's time for me to finally start my 2 weeks of self-isolation. Actually, Rosh Hashanah's coming up. Yom Kippur. Let's make it 2 months. 2 months self-isolation. I should probably do it. You know what? I'll be back when the kiddish and talking starts. That's more my speed. Anyway, it's warm out, so I need to go and sit outside in the garden and see if I can burn myself to a crisp, as is the British tradition. Have a very good weekend, have a good Shabbos, and I will see you next week. Goodbye.
Thank you very much to comedian Ashley Blaker there with some wise and humorous words for us as we conclude this edition of the JN Podcast. So all that's left for me to do is to say thank you very much to Tracy Ann Oberman. Thank you also to Maureen Lipman, as well as Joe Gross, Rabbi Charlie Baginski, and of course, we must also remember to thank our pay-per-view team. They were Justin Cohen and Fran Wolfish. And also, we must say thank you very much to Justin Cohen, who has produced this episode of the JN Podcast. And of course, thank you to you for listening as well. Please do remember to subscribe to the show in your podcast application. That way you'll be able to hear any previous episode or be informed of any new episodes as and when they become available. And don't forget that for more information on any of the stories that we've featured, you can always go to jewishnews.co.uk. And if you'd like to comment, we would love to hear from you. You can always email editorial@thejngroup.com. That's editorial@thejngroup.com. From me, Phil Dave, do join us next time here on the JN Podcast. Goodbye.